It was a couple of weeks ago that Graham spoke from here, and you'll remember, those of you who are here, he spoke out of Ezra Nehemiah's story. As he was speaking, I just couldn't help a smile coming, because I remember a previous occasion where the person who read and the person who preached were on the same subject, using the same material. Now, about 16 or 17 years ago, that probably means that only Graham and Molly might remember this, at a ground-level conference, a guy from Northern Ireland called Dave Matthews was preaching. Now, Dave had a wicked sense of humour. I found that a lot when I was living in Northern Ireland. They set you up, and they caused you to be laughed at, but it's all very, very good-hearted. Now, Dave Matthews asked one of the leaders on the platform if he would read the passage that he was going to preach on. Do you remember, Graham? You don't? Oh, well, it was the same passage. Now, you may remember that last week we were treated to a masterly presentation, a fluent presentation by Graham, which had all those difficult to pronounce names in it, coming one after the other, succession of them. And Graham took it at high speed. I thought it was absolutely wonderful. Anyway, this leader who was called to read the passage before Dave Matthews preached, Dave Matthews cruelly gave him 3 seconds to prepare, and the meeting started, and he said, so-and-so, I won't say his name, so-and-so will read a passage from the Bible for me. And we in the ground level audience at that time were sitting there, and as we watched this guy stumbling through and struggling to get the pronunciation right and so on, he was really having a hard time. But it was gradually what happened to that audience there was that there were smiles, a twinkle in the eye, and then a ripple of laughter, because we realized that Dave Matthews had set him up. Okay? And then it exploded into real laughter. Dave Matthews came forward, and then he preached. And I have to say that he preached a sermon which I remember to this day, because it was the day when he brought to me that little gem that lies in the middle of all those lists of people's names, the prayer of Jabez. Jabez, who said to God, "God, bless me," and God did. The story is very short, only occupies a tiny little bit, and you can read the whole book and not notice it. But I have to say to you that it's the first time I've met that, and it spoke a lot to me. But I do remember the occasion well. I thought Graham did superbly when he read those names. But the other thing that it struck up on me was that I have to make a confession to you. That confession I need to make before we start looking at Abraham and the sacrifice of Isaac. I've been preaching now for almost 60 years. And I look back on my speaking notes, and I found that over 90% of my sermons were based upon the New Testament, and only a tiny fraction on the Old. Now, it wasn't because I deliberately decided that I was going to neglect the Old and always preach from the New. It was just that, given the challenge of preaching, the message always seemed to me to be better mirrored from the words of the New Testament. And I went naturally to them without making a conscious decision. And I found I was reading the Gospels or Romans or something like that. And so I preached from that. It wasn't a chosen pattern, but it was my natural instinct. Why do you think this was? Why do I think it was? I think it probably was in part because before I became a Christian, I'd had many years of rejection of Christianity and of rebellion against the church, and I hadn't come up in a church base, and so I'd hardly ever looked at the Old Testament except for some very crummy RE lessons at school, which didn't do anything to bless the Old Testament to me at all. Now, what happened to me was that the Word of God that challenged me, that brought me to my knees to Christ, was not with words. It was the life of two men whose lives spoke eloquently about Jesus and about the love of God and about the joy of being a disciple. And so I got to know these two men. They hardly ever use words to preach to me, but I couldn't escape the witness of their lives. And I knew when I did challenge them, they said, it's all about Jesus. It's all about Jesus. So, before I made my confession, before I became a Christian, I started to reread the Gospels. And so I read about the life of Jesus. And it came to me with surprising freshness. And it struck me, and it brought me to the point where I was, literally, one evening in the home of the minister who was the minister of the church that I was beginning to go to. I was on my knees there saying, Jesus, if you really are alive, I want to follow you. And that was the beginning of my Christian life. But as I became a Christian, I went through and went on from the Gospels and read more and more. I read from the Acts of the Apostles. I read from the letters of Paul and letter of John. And I was immersing myself more and more in the New Testament, but hardly ever in the Old. Not as a deliberate policy. But in a sense, what I realized was that the essential of my change of life was that at the center was intimacy with Jesus. That was more important to me than anything else, and it still is, to be frank. And so consequently, I was looking at the life of Jesus. I was looking at the disciples of Jesus. I was looking at what they wrote, and I was meditating on that, and I was listening to Christians. And so I never really got into the Old Testament. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not rejecting the Old Testament at all. I know with my brain, how it is treasured by so many people for whom I have very great respect. It's just that it doesn't come instinctively to me. I open my Bible more towards the back than the front. And I know the Old Testament is the Bible that Jesus read, the only one he had. I know the disciples had the Old Testament and not the New, because it wasn't written then. But apart from the Psalms, which I did begin to mine into and found treasures in, and even there I was a bit picky, because there are some Psalms I still don't understand why the passage is in them. And I'm being honest with you, but I don't want to pose here as somebody who has the Bible in a kind of respect which I don't have. For me, I look at the Psalms, and there are some Psalms, and when I read them, I tend to read all but two or three verses, which I haven't come to terms with yet. But the Psalms are there for my personal enjoyment. I read them, I delight in them. They're a vehicle for praise and a stimulus for thanksgiving. But I was a Gentile convert to Christianity, as you all were. And so I didn't come through the path of Judaism in any sense. I didn't come through the Old Testament path. And for me, the New Testament is my check book, not my C-H-E-Q-U-E book, but the book by which I check that I've understood what I believe God is saying. And for me, the word is a lamp for my feet, yes, quoting from the Psalms. But it's Jesus, the living word, made flesh, who is my light. The Old Testament stories for me need to be considered in the light of the new. And if they don't agree, I don't reject the old, but I tend to suspend judgment a bit and say, that's a passage I haven't understood. But if I ask myself today, where in the Bible is my guide to action? What clearly speaks about Christian life choices? I go to the New Testament. Someone once commented on the Bible in this way. They said, it isn't the passages I understand that worry me. I'm sorry. I've spoiled that line, haven't I? Well, that was a crummy verse. It isn't the passages I don't understand that worry me, he said. It's the passages I do, because I've got to respond to them. And I have no excuse, because I understand. Right. That was preliminary to getting into Genesis, chapter 22. And the word, if I could have that on the screen, please. I've got to go through this passage because it repaid the mining and the exploration that I've done on it, I believe. I've got so much from it. I knew it before. I had heard sermons on it, and it meant a lot to me. But now, as I explore into it more and more deeply, I find more and more that's of value. God tested Abraham. And I deliberately used the translation which said God tested Abraham rather than God tempted Abraham. Because for me, it's Satan who's the tempter. Satan who tempts, God tests. He doesn't always do it. He's not as testing as all that. But he does test those who love him. He doesn't tempt them. But it's easy, if you read this, unless you pause on it, to miss the breathtaking significance of the challenge, the command that God gave to Abraham. Abraham turned attentively to God when God spoke to him. "Here I am," he replied. And then God said, "Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I'll tell you about." That's a pretty staggering little paragraph, if you think about it. Really is incredible challenge. Your only son, Isaac, whom you love. Your only son. Isaac was the one who all the previous promises of God referred to. It was in Isaac and dependent upon Isaac's line that all the enormous and amazing promises, which we find almost difficult to comprehend, were to come into being. Your only son, Isaac, and sacrifice him as a burnt offering at a place I'll tell you about. There's an obedience here that God is asking for. And it's amazing. We find it difficult because we know the end of the story. One of the reasons we don't get the value out of it, in a sense, is because we know how the story ends. Have you ever been, you've read a book, and you're in conversation with people, and you say to them, "I've just read this book. I found it fascinating." And you start to talk about it, and somebody who's listening to you says, "Stop, please. I'm only on page 2. I don't want to hear how it ends." Have you ever been in that situation? If I know how a story is going to end, it devalues all of the emotions and all the thinking of the characters up to that point, because they don't know how it's going to end. And here, I want us to try. Now, it's actually impossible to do, in my understanding, but we can try and do it. Can we try and put ourselves in the position of those who've never heard the Abraham and Isaac story before? Well, you can't, but just try now for a little while. See if we can enter into it, because we really do need to see how Abraham felt and how Abraham acted in the light of what he felt and what God had commanded him to do. Abraham is a giant in our history. What Abraham did was outstanding. And on top of sacrificing his son, who embodied the whole of Abraham's family future, which is the family of nations, effectively. On the top of that, God said, "I'll tell you where to do it when you're halfway there." God had tested Abraham before in this way. I don't know whether you remember this, but before we come to this episode in the life of Abraham, Abraham was told by God to get up and go from the area which he lived in. An area which he was living in which he was prospering, which was had family roots, an area where he was doing well as a Bedouin herdsman anymore, but a Bedouin who was able to bring a very, very rich estate before the sight of all the people around. He was doing extremely well. God said to him, get up and go, and as you go, I'll tell you where to go. That demands a kind of obedience. The way Abraham looked at God, he got up immediately and he went. That takes quite a bit of doing, in my view. The place he left was probably a place called Ur, U-R, which is a favourite for crossword puzzles and things. Ur was a village in what is now called Iraq, which I was near but not able to visit while I was working in Iraq. And God said to Abraham, get up and go. In Ur, the people researching in Ur, looking at the archaeology of the place, have discovered that there was a stepped pyramid, a pyramid built with steps, not with smooth sides, where you could go to the top where there's a flat platform on which human sacrifice was offered. And Abraham got up and left and went. You know that on the way he encountered a famine in what was now called Palestine, which was the place that God had wanted him to go to. And he went down into Egypt where there was food, but he came back. Right. Can we move on to verses 3-5 now? God had this word for Abraham, and Abraham wasted no time in obeying. That kind of swift obedience is a quality. I can remember when I was taxed with a very, very little challenge by God, and God said to me through somebody else, I want you to go to Liberia because there are people there who need help. And I fasted and prayed for about 3.5 seconds and then went, because I knew that if I dillied and dallied, turning it over and thinking about it too much, I'd probably never get there. But I knew that prompt obedience was what was needed, and so I went. That obedience, that quality of responding as quickly as possible, is something which we all desire, but most of us seek counsel. We go to others, we get advice, we listen, we think, we talk about it. Abraham seems to have done this all on his own, which is probably why he's called the father of our people. He's the great figure of the Old Testament. The important thing is, Abraham obeyed straight away. And they walked for 3 days, and he saw the place God had spoken of, and he recognized he must be nearly there. And look and see what he told his servants. He said, wait here, we will go and worship. He didn't mention anything about burnt offering and sacrificing his son. He said, we'll go and worship. And then we will come back to you. Now, there's a contradiction here we can all see straight away. Because Abraham's understanding at that point was that he was to kill his son and offer his body as a burnt offering to God. But he said to his servants, we will come back to you. Abraham was able to live with a contradiction, a paradox, something where two things that he's got in his mind can't both be true at the same time. But he was able to live with them. That's not easy. I live with some paradoxes. I don't handle them as well as Abraham did, but I live with some paradoxes. There are things which I can't reconcile. Out of life, out of the scriptures, out of a variety of things. The question is not about our thinking, but about our action. How do we act? And Abraham went on in obedience, carrying the contradiction. Isaac cannot be sacrificed, and he can't at the same time be the line through which the promises of God will be kept. Can we go to the next passage, please? We notice straight away that as far as Abraham's concerned, he could carry that contradiction, and he had to carry it again in the light of what his son Isaac said to him. Notice, incidentally, it's a very small point, but he carried the fire. Abraham carried the fire and the knife for the sacrifice. So the evidence is there of what he was going to do. But I say the fire, it's just worth mentioning. I would construct that not as meaning a kind of brazier full of burning coals, which he carried for 3 days and kept going, but a little package which apparently Bedouins do carry in the desert, which has a flint in it and tinder stuff to start a fire. And that's what he was carrying. But the important point is that he said to Isaac, his son, when Isaac asked him about the lamb, he said, God himself will provide. This was not an answer in one complete sense. It was an incomplete answer. But remember what I said about the story as it's unfolded so far. The complete answers come with retrospection, with looking back when the story is over. This is an incomplete answer, but Abraham's going ahead in obedience on the strength of that answer. God will provide. He says, God will provide the lamb. Okay, so Abraham then bound his son, can we have the next slide, and put him on the wood on the altar. He started on the final act of killing his son. Now, all the way through, I've said how difficult it is to enter into the mind of Abraham to see what's really happening as he continues to obey with servant, trusting, childlike obedience. Kill your son. There are lots of fathers in this room. Kill your son. It's almost too difficult to handle. That's why I say that there's a terrific contradiction here. Abraham continued to obey, yet he clearly trusted God at the same time. And he put his trust in God above his own understanding and his ability to reconcile the paradox. So Abraham left him there on the altar and was about to kill him. And then the angel calls with great urgency, Abraham, Abraham, to stop him. And he says this to him, now I know that you fear God because you've not withheld from me. Withheld from me. It's an angel talking, and yet withheld from me is withholding from God. Is this a God or is this an angel speaking? But the whole story of Abraham moves from meeting messengers of God and hearing them speak to him as God. And he copes with that much more easily than we do. But believe me, it happens in prophecy sometimes, even within this church, that somebody is speaking the words of God, and if you just take them in isolation, it sounds as though it's God speaking. Now that I know you fear God, because you've not withheld from me your son. And it isn't fear in the sense of blind terror. This is fear in the sense of the most profound kind of respect for the greatness of another, and the greatness in this case of God. And the angel then points out to Abraham that if he turns round, he can see the sacrifice, rare, ready to be sacrificed, that God had chosen to provide in that situation. And now we know how the story ends. And Abraham called that place, God will provide. And then in verses 15 to 19, God reaffirms his promises to Abraham. And he went on to Beersheba. But the place where Abraham sacrificed Isaac is subsequently known by the same word, which is also now the Jewish title which is given to God, the title Jehovah Jireh, God who provides. Our God is able to provide. And this is something which many of us know, many of us who've travelled overseas, many of us who've worked in strange places, many of us who've been through poverty and hardship. Our God is a God who provides, Jehovah Jireh. Now, that's an amazing confidence that Abraham has in God. We haven't ever encountered anything, and anywhere near the scale of this. This is quite beyond our class, as it were. We're punching above our weight if we try and imagine that we can stand with this. Abraham, outstanding. But as we reflect on it, we find that there are examples of people who have similarly believed in God and trusted him in simple obedience, almost childlike obedience, right the way through, when all the evidence around seems to be saying the opposite. I think of the one who was referred to, interestingly, this morning in the prayer for Rich, about the three men who were cast into the burning fiery furnace. It speaks about the furnace there. That's what it reminded me of. And there was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, three prisoners, but prisoners with honor, who were living in a foreign land and who were living under Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And they refused to worship Nebuchadnezzar when everybody was commanded to worship him and to worship the golden idol that he'd set up. And so Nebuchadnezzar said, well, the punishment's been declared already. You know what it is. You're going to be thrown in this furnace. But it's the reply of the three men, which I have to say, I find quite amazing. They say this: the God whom we serve is able to save us from the furnace. And he will rescue us from your hand. But even if he doesn't, we want you to know we're not going to worship your image. And we're not going to worship you. So it's rather like they say, our God is able, and we're confident he will, but if not, we're still not going to worship your gods. And that was the same kind of obedience in the face of a paradox which those three men went into, and we know that they survived the furnace through the grace of God. When I reflect on Abraham's obedience, I have to ask this kind of question today. Have you ever felt a call of God to do something at all difficult or costly? I know we're not in the same league as Abraham, but many of us have been convinced that God wants us to do something particular that seems to us at the time a very big step to take. But we have an enormous benefit. We are surrounded by what the writer to the Hebrews calls a host of witnesses. We are surrounded by the stories that have come through to us, through from the Bible, from the early church, from the church history, through to now. And even here, we have the witness of those who come back or come out of a situation and stand in front of you here and say, God did provide. We're surrounded by such witnesses and all the witness of the Bible. God has given us lives that we can look at that speak about this. We're able to hear God and hear what God has done to the lives of others. And that's why we give such a great importance to testimony. Testimony is saying it as it is. This is my testimony as a witness of what God has done. And this is an enormous encouragement to us. We are in a stronger position through the lives and words of others in that way. We know the stories of people of faith And we know of a God who sacrificed his own son that we might be forgiven and inherit eternal life. So we can have confidence in him. This is our God. Whatever he says, do.